Hello and welcome to the April 2026 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. Let us find out what we have in store for you this month. John Townsend will be in conversation with Luke Whitlock. This will be followed by a piece of music composed by Luke himself. Fran Frank has put together another set of 10 quiz questions for you. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will be sharing his poem entitled A Family of Lies. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. Norma Ortey will be reading her story entitled Letter to the Traffic Department. Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob is back with us after a break and will be sharing a bit of This and That. Roland Burroughs will be reading another extract from his memoir. This one is from the chapter The Women in My Life and is about the influence of his mother, grandmother, friends and mostly female colleagues who were his mentors and guides. Jenny Horton will be reading her poem entitled What Do You Hide? Sue Smallwood is joining us after her travels and will be sharing part one of her Arctic adventures in Norway last November. In her segment, One Foot in the Past, Viv Wilson will be talking about the water supply in our area in the early 20th century. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. In part two of his segment, entitled My Great Passion in Life, David Quay will be sharing his love of the music and lyrics of Gilbert and Sullivan. We will conclude the programme with a piece of music from Gilbert and Sullivan's The Gondoliers. Here is John Townsend with his guest.
Hello, it's John Townsend again with another Performing Arts Devon Dialogues, where I get to chat with musicians, actors, singers, dancers, theatrical directors, and more besides, who work and perform both locally and further afield. My guest today is a musician, composer, and BBC producer who currently lives in Devon, but whose music reaches far beyond. So a big welcome to our studio, Luke Whitlock, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
Well, what better place for me to research you, Luke, than the Royal College of Music, from where, they say, after graduating, you became Chamber Concerts Coordinator at the RCM between 2002 and 2004, and then music tutor at Dartington College of Arts and Exeter College. Since then, you've orchestrated a Hollywood film, released several albums and had music broadcast around the world. As a BBC Radio 3 producer, you've produced over 100 editions of Composer of the Week, as well as editions of The Choir, Opera on 3, and The Sunday Feature. And you also present for In the Studio on BBC World Service. You've taught at the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, give lectures in various universities across the UK relating to diversity in classical music and broadcasting. Wow, that's a real, quite a CV, no doubt needing, well, more than one programme to cover it all. But I'd like to start, first of all, with how your music making began, as it seems you must have musical bones. So before you tell us about some of your creative work over the years, can I ask my usual question? How did it all start? I'm intrigued to know how you caught the, if I can call it, the music bug, and whether it's in your DNA, whether you had an inspirational teacher, or perhaps a blinding flash of epiphany in your youth. Take us back a little, would you, to where your music journey first began? Maybe when you were very small. Over to you.
I think that's exactly right, John. It was absolutely when I was very small. And yes, I don't think music was ever going to be not an option, shall we say, because having a father, and many of your listeners may be aware of a group called the Teen Valley Stompers, if they're into jazz. Mm. My father is a trad jazz banjo player and has been for absolute, you know, decades now. So growing up in a family, and I'm the youngest of three children, music was always there. You would be listening to it all the time. You'd be hearing my father playing it. You'd be going to concerts, and at school and in our home life, our private home life, we're encouraged to learn instruments, a number of instruments. So from a very early age, music was there, and actually also the theatre, because from the age of three, I was thrown on the stage in local pantomime sort of thing. And all, you know, my brother and sister were as well.
Yeah.
So music and theatre, we were never going to escape it.
Yeah. And are they musicians now as well, doing performing and playing?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yes. And what's interesting is that we all very much went in our own direction. So I'm the only one who went into the classical music genre.
Yes.
And my other siblings have gone in other
directions. It must be fun at Christmas when you all get together with all your instruments and whatever.
Yes. Yes. We'll leave that one there, I think. I mean, I think the thing is, when you're all so your focus is very different genres of music. In a way, it's like speaking another language.
Yeah. Oh,
so it's not actually as easy as that.
What about school? I mean, you're a Devon lad, and you went to school in...
So I went to school in Tynmouth.
Tynmouth, right.
My secondary school was Tynmouth Community College. In fact, again, for any of your listeners who know the pop band Muse, they're my age. I was in the same class.
So you rub shoulders with them?
Yeah, well, yes. I knew them at school. Let's put it like that. So yes, but the funny thing is that... Actually, by the time I got to secondary school, classical music was my thing.
Mm.
And classical music was not the thing to be taught in secondary school.
I was going to ask that.
Exactly. So by the time I got to choosing options, you know, GCSE options, A-level options, I totally dropped out of music because the provision at school...
It wasn't up to...
Wasn't what I was interested in.
What a shame.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it was fine because I kept all my... private music tuition on, learning the piano, learning clarinet, music theory, and doing all the grades.
Right.
So I kept things going that way. But music at school, was not interest.
Not choir even?
Yes. So towards the end of my studies at school, so A-level period, I was enticed by the music tutor back into choirs.
Yes.
But No.
I mean, this is the big worry now, isn't it? In schools, the music work and choirs seem to be, well, not in all schools, shall we say?
Well, no, not in all schools, but also I think, you know, even when I was young, I was an anomaly.
Yes.
You know, so I think we have to remember that when music was being taught at school, it was being aimed at more contemporary genres of music to interest the people of that time.
Yes.
And I totally understand that.
Yeah. Do you have any involvement now in either schools or young people? Do you have much connection with those who are... Because I'm always concerned about how, you know, the new generation are coming through and picking up
Not music. Really at the moment, and that's only because I've only recently moved back to this area.
Okay.
So I haven't got involved with things as of yet. But as you said in your kind introduction, you know, over the years I've taught at the Royal Welsh College, Dartington College of Art, which no longer exists, sadly, various places, and have been involved in giving, you know, seminars, presentations at universities about various things. So I have been involved on those levels.
Right.
But otherwise, no.
No. But let's get into the actual creating, writing music. Mm. So there you are. You've gone through school. You go to... When did you go to the Royal College of Music? Was that...
Right. So I started at the Royal College of Music in 2000. Prior to that, I had undertaken an undergraduate at Dartington College of Arts.
Right.
And it was at Dartington, actually, where composition really took off for me.
Right.
Dartington, as a number of people may know, it was very liberal, very outward thinking, and actually they only had 4 degree courses there, all arts related, that's all. And the essence of those all 4 degrees was contemporary arts and also collaboration. So there you are, you're being forced to collaborate with writers, with theatre practitioners, with performance artists. So it was just well, it was a riot of fun, quite
frankly. Right, I was going to ask, did it suit you?
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Yeah. Absolutely loved it. And just such an odd environment. You know, there it is in the centre of Devon, surrounded by fields, and you can hear a steam train. And there you are, all are, you know, just it's going mad.
Producing music.
Yeah.
So you say you were doing composition. Are we talking for just a group of musicians? Are you talking orchestral?
So at Dartington, it was very much aimed at the musicians who are there available to you, so small chamber groups.
Yes.
By the Royal College of Music, I was writing symphonic music, but I also focused upon writing for film, which is what my master's was in.
I see.
And then over the years, it's really been about what commissions have come in.
Right.
So that might be something choral, or it might be something chamber, which I had for a wind trio in New Zealand, or it might be let's work with this pianist and produce a disc of solo piano works. So it depends
on
the
huge range, isn't it? Doing something for film must be a completely different discipline, because it's you're working presumably to visual.
Well, exactly. You are, and you're not only working to that visual stimulus, but you're also working to very tight time deadlines. So you need to create 30 seconds worth of music, and at the 25th second, you have to hit a certain sync point to create a certain effect.
Yeah.
You know, so it's entirely different.
But when it works, it must be fabulous.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. But actually, I then decided after training in that, although I did work in film a bit, and as you said, I was an orchestrator for a Hollywood film, I actually decided this was an industry I didn't want to remain in, actually, because it's rather stressful.
And
it's not necessarily where I want to go with music.
No, I see. Well, I think that's a good place to pause on, and I'd love you to chat with me again for the next month's programme, but we need to finish with a piece of music of your choice. I wonder if it's going to be one of your pieces and what it might be, and tell us a bit about it.
Okay, so it is one of my pieces, and it's for solo piano. It's part of a suite of pieces I wrote called Oceanic Interludes. And it's quite funny, I was thinking about this morning. I wrote it during the pandemic, and at the time I was living in Cardiff.
Yes.
So quite far from the southwest coast, but there I was thinking of the seaside, of my time living in Devon, and now of course I've returned to Devon. So it's a piece of solo piano. It's in three movements. I'm going to suggest we hear the third movement, called The Shoal. Each of the three movements are sort of depictions on a sea theme, but I'm not going to say any more than that, because I love it that listeners can actually
bring
decide
to it
what is going on.
Will we be able to smell the surf, Luke?
I'm not sure about smelling the surf, but I think certainly have a visual of the beautiful sunshine glistening on the sea.
All right. I shall hold that in my mind as we go over to tell me who is playing it.
So, as I said, the piece is called The Shoal,
yes,
and it's performed by the pianist Duncan Honeyball.
Right. Well, thank you for that. We look forward to hearing it. And for now, thank you very much, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have just listened to Oceanic Interludes, Third Movement, The Shoal, with Duncan Honeybourne on the piano. The music is composed by Luke Whitlock. It is now over to Fran Frank for the quiz questions.
Hello again. Another month and another set of questions. Are you sitting comfortably? Then let's start with question one. What type of creature is a bittern? Is it A, a monkey, B, a fish, or C, a bird? Question 2. According to a poem by Sir Walter Scott entitled Marmion, Oh What a Tangled Web We Weave When First We Practice What? Is it A, to believe, B, to thieve, or C, to deceive? Question 3. What colour do Oxford students wear at a sporting event when representing their university? Is it A, light blue, B, pale green, or C, dark blue? Question 4. What does a cricket umpire indicate by raising his index finger in the air? Is it A, wide, B, six, or C, out? Question 5. Which US state, nicknamed the Sunshine State, is known for its amusement parks and the production of oranges? Is it A, New Mexico, B, California, or C, Florida? Question 6. Rod Laver is a former world number one player in which sport? Was it A, snooker, B, rowing, or C, tennis? Question 7. House, harvest, and wood are all varieties of which British mammal? Is it A, bat, B, mouse, or C, mole? Question 8. Which famous author lived at Greenaway House on the River Dart? Was it A, Arthur Conan Doyle, B, Agatha Christie, or C, Charles Dickens? Question 9. Phyllis Logan played Lady Jane Felsham in which BBC comedy drama series? Was it A, Mrs. Brown's Boys, B, Lovejoy, or C, To the Manor Born? Question 10. In which county is the historic town of Sandwich? Is it A, Leicestershire, B, Cheshire, or C, Kent? Well, there are your 10 questions together with 3 possible answers per question. Enjoy the rest of the programme and I'll be back again later to give you the correct answers, or at least confirm your results if you know them anyway.
David Picton is here with his poem for this month.
Here is a poem about telling lies, which perhaps we all do from time to time. But a warning that even simple lies may build on each other, as single lies turn into a whole family of lies. And the poem's called A Family of Lies. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Those words are from Sir Walter Scott. Little lies make up our lives, weave in and out our days. We try to be honest. We try to be honest. We try to be honest always. But we tell our little lies. We set our sights on being true. But wishing well is not enough. Somewhere, somewhen, out of the blue, on other foot we slip on other shoe, as we tell our little lies. It's little lies that lead astray, where one lie steps, another treads. From straight and narrow path we stray. Sometimes we stray too far away, as we tell our little lies. One lie begets, and others feed. Beget, begat, begot the lot. Lies lie on lies, like rabbits breed. Familial lies sprout up from seed. As we tell more little lies. A baby lie just grows and grows, and one's brand new roam free. Before you know, you lose control, creating bigger family, each one a sibling of one before, as you tell yet more and more, each one related to the first, from bad to badder, worse to worst, and still we tell our little lies. Once we start, we cannot stop. They take on life their very own. On fleet of foot we hope and hop, as little lies for truth we swap, and wish the web of lies we weave do their job as we deceive. White little lies may do no harm, as they spin their naughty charm. But have a thought, and don't forget, as you cast your lying net, remember, you'll not be forgot, as lies you tell tie Gordian knot. Yet, still we tell our little lies.
Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor are here with this month's book review.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have read North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. I read all the introduction and some of the glossary, though not really necessary. This is a lovely state of class, new money people, industrial divide, bucolic cottage living and grinding working class geography, a social study exercise bringing it all together. Very many ups and downs along the way. True love will find a way.
Yes, so this is a classic Victorian novel. It was written in the 1850s. It's about the 1850s, so it's the height of the Industrial Revolution. And the title North and South really refers to, well, it's partly, I think, the love triangle that's at the centre of this. But there's a main protagonist. She's called Margaret Hale, and she's a young woman. And she moves with her family from the south of England, from a village in Hampshire where her father is a rector, living in a small village, very cozy, stable, you know, all of those things. And they move to a place called Milton, which is really Manchester. And it's 19th century Manchester, so it's mills and it's working class and it's all kinds of industrial conflict and so on. And it's really about the contrast between the two lives and the different sets of values that she encounters in her two worlds.
Aggravated, I think, slightly by the fact that though she lives in relative poor state, she was raised in a household of great wealth, great comfort, and she has a very good sense of self, and therefore her position in society she sees as quite heightened. And to come across people of poverty when they go to the village is fine, because she knows her place, they know their place, and it's all lovely. But going to Manchester really throws up a lot of problems for her socially, in her inner self, in the understanding that she feels that she should be in that class, but because they're working class and loaded, that's where the divide comes. She finds it very difficult to marry those two socially, but her heart now becomes involved, and that's where her real problems lie.
It's partly a conventional 19th century romance of the kind that, you know, Jane Austen or Charlotte Bronte would have written, a love triangle at the centre of it. But it's so much more than that, because there's a lot of social commentary as well. So it's a lot about the mill owners and the way they treat their workers and the strikes and so on that go on. But she's not really judgmental. There are no villains or heroes in this. It's all very real. You understand where everyone's coming from. There's a lot of light. There's a lot of shade. And it's really social commentary in addition to romance that makes it so interesting.
Oh, yes. And I think as well, her own personality is incredibly sympathetic generally for the hardships of the workers, for the problems of the upper class, the, as she sees it, the problem of the working class who have been elevated. Fortunately, one of the heroes' mother believes herself to be great on the strength of her son's greatness. So that's a big help. But it's wonderfully portrayed. I really, really enjoyed it. And because it was written by a woman in the time that she was writing, there is no falseness. There's no pretense. That's the way it is. That's the way it is in her lifetime. So we look back and we get a picture of her lifetime through this wonderful story that she's written about the time and the social layers, really, that she lives through.
There's also a little subplot involving her brother, who is stuck overseas, can't come back because he's been involved in a kind of naval mutiny and he'd be arrested and so on. And I found that it propels the plot, and it's a little, it adds something to it.
It does, because it takes it away from the banal, really, and brings that little adventurous twist. But the other side of that is, of course, he becomes himself again. He finds a new way, even though it's abroad. But it's the intrigue it brings into the story as well for the family. It's just lovely. I've written myself a joy to read an old-fashioned classic. And I, despite my modern woman impatience of the slowness to speak of true meanings, I just really, really enjoyed it.
Well, next month we're going to be reading a totally different kind of book. Now, this is by the contemporary American writer Lionel Shriver. It's a male name, but it's a woman. Lionel Shriver is a woman. She lives in Britain, I think, but she's American. And this book is called The Mandibles, and it's set in the near future. So I think it starts about 2029, where she wrote it some time ago, but it's getting close now. And it's a dystopian-like novel, I think, about a financial collapse. I haven't read it yet. I think you have.
Oh, must read it. It's terrifyingly realistic.
So that's what we're going for next time. Very, very different from Victorian England to the future in America. That's The Mandibles by Lionel Shriver.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. We now have Norma Orty with her story entitled Letter to the Traffic Department. This is from an actual incident that occurred when she and her husband lived in South Africa.
A letter to the traffic department in George in South Africa. Dear sir or madam, I have received a letter from your good self requesting that I pay a traffic violation fine of 1,000 rand. You state that I was photographed in York Street travelling at 100 kilometres per hour, the state speed limit being 60. I wish to tell you the mitigating circumstances. I am a pensioner in my 70th year. I have held a licence since 1965. And have never violated the law. On the day in question, I was in Mossel Bay with my elderly husband. We were in a social group visiting a factory. Not that there was much to see. It was a fish factory and there were no fish to pack. My husband was suddenly ill, vomiting and suffering with severe pains in his lower back. After he had vomited discreetly in the felt, he was a little better, and we proceeded to lunch. Lunch was prepared at a restaurant for 50 of the social club members. It was very noisy and hot in there. There was a strong smell of fish and chips, which made him run to the men's room, again in great pain. At this point it was decided that we should return to the town of George as soon as we could and see our doctor. I found the way from the restaurant to the N2 highway and travelled at the speed limit of 120 on the highway. I reached the York Street exit. Here, traffic and 60 signs dictated that I slow down, and I continued towards the town centre at the correct speed. However, in my passenger seat, I had a big man writhing in agony and groaning, complaining that he was numb and his legs were going dead. He was blue around the mouth. This somewhat distracted me, and I may have momentarily gone a little faster. I reached the doctor, and even though it was lunchtime, he was there. I half carried my husband inside. He was examined and sent to the emergency hospital, where he was stabilized, receiving injections and a drip. His blood pressure was very high. I got him there just in time. He was x-rayed and a kidney stone was found to be lodged in the tube connecting the kidney and the bladder. Consequently, he was moved to the clinic for 2 nights and operated on to remove the stone. Hopefully, you will reduce this fine, which will enable me to pay some of the hospital expenses. On camera, I suspect that my red open-top sports car looked faster than it really was. Yours sincerely.
In her story, Norma used the word veld, which is Afrikaans and Dutch for field or flat grassland. I bet you are interested to know the outcome of the letter. Well, Norma did not have to pay the fine. Jeannie is back after a bit of a break from Roundabout with This and That.
Thank you. Hello again. I was recently once again in Bude on the north coast of Cornwall. As is often the case when I'm in Bude, I found myself walking past the tall, pointy structure situated just in front of the castle. This tall, pointy structure is known as the Bude Light and was commissioned by the local council to celebrate the millennium and to commemorate the invention of limelight by that very clever Victorian fellow, Sir Goldsworthy Gurney. The Bude Light is conical in shape, made up of different coloured concrete sections placed upon one another in ever-decreasing circles. It is also studded with fibre optic lights to represent the star constellations. The artist responsible for this work of art was Carol Vincent, in collaboration with Anthony Fanshawe. Carol Vincent was an artist, sculptor and teacher who I was fortunate to meet and thought you might like to hear a little bit about her life and work. Carol was born in 1939 and sadly passed away in 2019. She is probably best known for her concrete sculptures. The Bude Light being just one of many sculptures she was commissioned to create for a public space. In fact, you have probably seen one or more of Carol's sculptures here in Devon. Her water sundial, for example, known as the Armada Dial, situated in the centre of Plymouth. Or perhaps her Year of the Pedestrian, of which four were commissioned and can be found in Exeter, Torquay, Plymouth and Barnstable. I find Carol's sculptures very attractive, with their smooth, simple lines and very little detail, and yet obvious as to what they are. And like all good sculptures, makes you want to touch them. Have you ever been to a sculpture exhibition and been forbidden to touch? This is most frustrating, especially for a visually impaired person like me, who wants to touch absolutely everything. I do have some understanding, though, for such policies. After all, Stonehenge might not quite be the monument we know today if it had not been fenced off to protect it from the public. Carol liked to experiment with colour and texture in concrete and pioneered the adding of natural pigments to concrete to create wonderful vibrant colours. Such colours can be seen in her Bude Light sculpture and her red carpet in Edinburgh. Carol studied at the Bath Academy of Art and also at the Chelsea College of Physical Education. She told me that she had once been a lifeguard here in Tynmouth. After college, she moved to Cornwall and took up a teaching role at John Smith School in Camelford. In 1971, Carol became self-employed and set up her own studio from her home in the beautiful village of Boscastle, from where she could work and teach. Carol was also a very keen gardener, and over the years, at her home in Boscastle, she created the most beautiful garden, adorned with many of her sculptures. She divided her garden up into secluded sections, linked together with enticing paths. One of these sections, down some steps and round a corner, holds Carol's circular ponds, edged with her very own homemade pastel-coloured concrete bricks. In 2001, Carol recreated this section of her garden at the Chelsea Flower Show, for which she was awarded a bronze medal. It was about 30 years ago, whilst holidaying in Bude with my parents one summer, that I heard there was a woman in Boscastle giving classes in sculpture. My interest was piqued. As a child, from the age of 10, I attended a school for visually impaired children, and art was about the only subject I was really any good at. I loved to draw and could draw for hours, admittedly with my nose on the paper in order to see what I was doing, but my drawings were always very detailed. When it came to leaving school at the age of 16, it was natural for me to consider art college. But this thought was quickly discouraged as a highly unsuitable career choice for a visually impaired student. So I took up business studies instead. As I moved into adulthood and was distracted by other emerging interests, I stopped drawing for pleasure. My sight continued to deteriorate, and when I took up art again in my 30s, I realised I had lost the ability to draw with any precision. It may have been possible for me to develop a totally different style of painting and drawing, but it occurred to me that sculpture could be a good creative alternative. And so, when I heard about these sculpture classes being offered in Cornwall, it was an opportunity I just had to explore. And that summer, my parents and I travelled down the coast from Bude to Boscastle to meet the sculpture lady, Carol Vincent. I have to admit to finding Carol rather intimidating at first. She spoke with a loud, gruff voice, which wouldn't have been out of place in the army, but kindly showed us around her little cottage, workshop and studio. She also gave us a tour of her garden, and we were delighted to find many of her sculptures dotted here and there, nestled amongst the foliage. I was captivated and eagerly signed up to attend a summer workshop the following year, where I spent 2 weeks learning how to make a concrete sculpture. When I first arrived at Carol's studio, I didn't have a clear idea of what I wanted to make a sculpture of, but Carol had the idea that the two kittens she had recently acquired might model for me. That saying, never work with children or animals, came to mind, but actually, when these two kittens were not running around the studio chasing ping pong balls, they were usually curled up asleep together, nice and still. It took a while to transform the lump of clay I had been given into something resembling two kittens curled up asleep together. I found that regular and frequent stroking of the two live models was not only good for my well-being, but helped me transfer what I was feeling to the clay. When I was as near as I could possibly get to being satisfied with my clay sculpture, the next stage was to cover it in plaster. When the plaster has completely dried, the clay is then removed, hopefully revealing a perfectly intact mould. Mixing the cement came next, and I had to choose a stone aggregate to add to the cement mixture, which would give a particular colour to my finished sculpture. The cement mixture is then poured into the mould and left for a day or so to completely dry out. Finally, chipping off the plaster mould to reveal one's concrete sculpture, hopefully all intact, is probably the most nerve-wracking part of the process. I was relieved to find my kitten's ears had all survived, and apart from a few blemishes, it had turned out quite well. All that remained was to give it a good rub down to remove any roughness for a finish smooth to the touch. This sculpture now resides at my parents' house, two kittens curled up asleep together by the fireplace. Thank you, Carol Vincent, for giving me the opportunity to discover and experience this creative art form.
If If you're interested in seeing any of Carol Vincent's sculptures, then there is, of course, the Armada Dial, a large sundial and fountain situated in Plymouth. Something closer to home is the Year of the Pedestrian, which is in Torquay. Roland Burroughs joins us with another extract from his memoir. Extracts from further chapters of Roland's memoir will appear in future programmes.
Hello, this is me again, Roland Burroughs, with another little chapter from my memoir. I'd always said, well, certainly throughout my late teens and those early boastful 20s, that I wanted to spend the rest of my life surrounded by beautiful women. Fortunately, that was exactly what happened, although it wasn't quite how I'd imagined. Be careful what you wish for. Perhaps I should start by explaining that women were never the mystery they seemed to be for some other young men. In my case, though, there is a simple explanation. Exposure. I can certainly look back and explain why I'm so aware of all the women in my life, because they certainly loom large and had a great influence. I'd grown up in the 1940s, in post-war Britain. I witnessed blitz streets and so many roads with craters. There were burned out roofless shells replacing what were once terraced houses. My childhood days were of dogs and beggars in the streets, coal fires and second-hand clothes, dirty urchins from destitute families and one-legged men selling matches and bootlaces. Our cottage was a refuge for the friends of my young mother, all rushing back to ours after work. Being in the very centre of Maidstone, we were the base for all family and friends as they got ready to go out for the evening, and Friday nights were especially full of excitement. It saved them the business of getting separate buses home, then catching one back again to all meet up in town. But it wasn't just a sing-song around the pub piano. The weekends were very special because somewhere in town a band would be playing. These would not be just any bands, because Maidstone was the capital of the County of Kent, a huge county stretching from South London to the English Channel. The town would be entertained by the big band orchestras of Bert Ambrose, Joe Loss, Johnny Dankworth, Jack Parnell, Eric Delaney, Billy Cotton, Ted Heath, Sid Lawrence, Count Basie, all legends in their own time, and so often recalled as giving Mum and Dad the time of our lives. So with no time for them to get home and back, instead Mum's friends filled our two up, two down with teacups, gorgeous red lips, long wavy hair, stockings, cigarettes and perfume. A full-blown beauty parlour bustling around me in front of the open fire. I'd listen to their banter. Flo, put the kettle on, will you, dear? Don't scorch yourself by the fire, love. Oh, Rona, can I borrow your blue scarf? Are my seams straight? Sylvia? Where's Sylvia gone with my lipstick? I was surrounded by the busyness, love, chatter, laughter, and all the friendly warmth of young women trying hard to create a fresh new world from the dying embers of the last one. Next, I should count the later 1950s, when we arrived in Canada, the first 8 months of which was spent with my four cousins, three of them girls around my age. And not forgetting my mum's sister, the formidable Aunt Ruby. She taught me more about matriarchy than all the episodes of EastEnders put together. Today she'd be called a strong woman. I thought she was fearsome. One very tough lady. No wonder all my cousins were scared of her. I can still picture her now chasing through the house with a large hairbrush held like a weapon. Oh, one of us was in for it. Later, back in the UK in 1961, and me now in the sixth form, we were 50-50 male-female pupils. We became agony aunts to each other's trepidation, satisfying a need for acceptance and explaining cures for teenage angst. Just eight in our whole class. I had four in my English class and just two of us in my geography class. So over those A-level days, we all became very close, very open and very supportive. One wanted to be an actress, and one a scientist. Two others wanted to be teachers. Going through my teens in daily contact with such strong companions certainly helped me to appreciate the intelligence, strength, and single-minded determination of those young women. Debates and a few arguments were an even contest between us, and I probably lost more than I won. Again, a similar pattern repeated during my gap year, spent between universities at a huge teaching hospital, where I was fortunate to be in a world of amazing female ward sisters and student nurses. Following that, up at Nottingham, I was in a college population of 5 women to each man. Not without a few advantages, of course. In the workplace environment during the 1960s-70s, so many men were holding the majority of management positions, but throughout my 25-year career in education, with so many professional, clear-headed and decisive senior-level women around me, I learned to work alongside, to admire and to feel at ease with them all. I also learned that sincere and respectful compliments do go a long way. I like to think that I matured with a belief and understanding of the beauty of women, their strength, their resilience, their courage and the intensity of their love. I was probably let down by more men because of their weakness, lack of understanding, and their need to prove some professional virility than I was ever disappointed by women in similar roles. 4 marriages may have redressed the balance here a little, but having my 3 daughters and watching them blossom into 3 amazing women certainly gave me more pleasure and fulfillment than I could ever have thought possible. And so with my wonderfully capable and loving new wife Sarah and my remarkable daughters, I am indeed surrounded by women. All very strong women, whom I can and do love and admire. Not such a bad scenario for sliding, or I prefer to think for striding, into my old age.
Jenny Horton is here to read her poem entitled, What Do You Hide?
What do you hide in that soul of yours? Are there secrets too shameful to share? What do you hide in that heart of yours? Is there heartache too painful to bear? What do you hide in that mind of yours? Are there memories you wish to forget? What do you hide in those thoughts of yours? Is there a life that you lived with regret? What do you hide in those eyes of yours? Are there tears or sadness or laughter? What do you hide in your visions and dreams? Is there hope for life and your future? What do you hide in that body of yours? Are there scars from the past that won't heal? What do you hide in that spirit of yours? Is there a faith that can save you when you kneel?
We now have Sue Smallwood with part one of her Arctic adventures in Norway last November.
All aboard the MS Polaris, Norway's mail boat, a bleak ferry boat, known locally as the Coastal Express, sailing between Bergen, Kirkenes, and back to Bergen. Myself and 3 friends embark on an Arctic adventure. Not a cruise ship, but the vessel servicing Norway's coastline up into the Arctic Circle. No fancy dining or dressing for dinner. No onboard entertainment. Dressing to leave the ship consists of how many layers do I need to wear and yet still be able to walk rather than roll along like a giant's roly-poly toy. Onboard personnel gave an informative talk every day about the ports we would visit in the following 24-hour period, and a camera club met daily to show their photos on the big screen. We were booked for the complete round trip, although as a working roll-on, roll-off ferry, there were numerous ports of call, some of which allowed only sufficient time to offload and load a small number of vehicles, mostly delivery lorries, and foot passengers sailing to the different islands rather than driving to their destination via the many bridges linking the islands. We embarked in Bergen alongside the colourful wharves of the UNESCO-listed Bryggen district, now an artisan quarter complete with cobblestone streets and brightly painted houses. It was a key trading port during the 14th to 18th century, and it was easy to imagine life back then as we wandered through narrow wooden alleyways. Next morning we left the ship at its fourth port of call, Ulsud, arriving at 9:45, scheduled to leave in the evening, so plenty of time for us to explore. For panoramic views, climb or drive to Axla. It's reached by climbing 418 steps, and we went all the way to the top, stopping at the viewpoint en route, ostensibly to take photos, but quite honestly to get our breath back. Our fellow passengers and walkers we passed on the way down were surprised to discover that this group of four ladies of a certain age had made it to the top. The viewpoint alone is 189 metres above sea level, so bring it on for girl power. In historic Trondheim, we set off, armed with a map, no knowledge of Norwegian, but our iPhones for emergency. The city was once the Norwegian capital, and we wandered along the seafront, stopping to watch a group of students make use of one of the bathing platforms. This was November, and we watched from a respectful distance, horrified and intrigued in equal measure as they stripped to bikinis and swimming trunks before immersing themselves in the icy waters of the ocean. Not for them the squeals and screams of the wussy British, but laughter of friends having a good time. That said, they weren't in for long and soon clambered up the ladder and into the waterside sauna hut, looking an awful lot pinker than when they went in. Meanwhile, we huddled inside our thermals and admired their enjoyment of this healthy pastime. This was the only day when we were exploring that I was apprehensive as we wandered through the colourful towns, houses of the old town, lost on the wrong side of the main railway line, no bridges in sight, with time ticking away until we had to board the ship. It was a Sunday, so there were very few people around. Church bells were ringing in all directions as the final few latecomers hurried to worship, dressed in their traditional costumes. It was a huge relief as we spotted the pedestrian bridge we'd seen some of our fellow travellers crossing earlier in the day. There had been the option of a guided walking tour or a coach trip, both at a price, and Norway is a very expensive country. We boarded the Polaris, glad to be in the warm and shed some of our many layers. When planning our holiday, we had decided to minimise the organised trips and do our own things, simply wandering and soaking up the atmosphere, sights and sounds of Norway. Our final port of call that first day was to Molde. In the summer, there might just be enough daylight to see the amazing view of 222 mountain peaks across the fjord towards what is called the Molde Panorama. From mid-June to late August, the streets and gardens here are adorned with the sight and scent of roses of all shades, living up to its nickname as the City of Roses. It must be a wonderful assault on the senses. We sailed on through the night, keeping our cabin tannoy switched on as the captain alerted passengers when the northern lights were active. Several times we left our warm bunks to climb into copious thermal layers, grab cameras and join fellow passengers on deck to marvel at nature's stunning display in shades of mauve, green and blue as the lights moved eerily across the jet black sky like a huge, living, friendly alien. The true spectacle has to be seen through your camera lens, as the human eye cannot pick up ultraviolet and infrared light. Hence, there are so many fabulous photos. Oxygen and nitrogen give yellow, green, blue colours at lower altitudes, while oxygen can also give the red colours at high altitude. By now, we are sailing northwest through the fields, with the snow falling, sugarcoating the passing panorama of inlets, tiny islands, isolated farmsteads, hillside and mountains, coated with a magical dusting of snow, contrasting sharply with the Black Sea and its foam-crested waves.
Sue will continue with part two of her Arctic adventures in next month's Roundabout. Viv Wilson is here with her segment, One Foot in the Past.
My, how we take things for granted. Just touch a tap and we get water. But in this story, I'm going to look back to a time when things were so very different. Let's just forget about the well-worn phrase, infrastructure, a word that would have been foreign to the small army of men captured in an early 20th century photograph of the construction of the reservoir at Hazeldown, Tynmouth. Their work looks hazardous, with simple planks to push the barrows up and down while digging out a huge hole in the ground by hand. We'll come back to that later. Let's just consider for a minute, when did it all begin? And the answer lies in the mid-19th century Improvement Act that identified the need to provide a water supply to every dwelling. It would have been a very welcome installation that put a stop to dragging every drop of water in from a well or nearby stream. But in order to supply this service, the storage of water was essential, hence the beginning of reservoirs. Today, Devon and Cornwall boasts 23 major reservoirs. But I wonder if you know when the first and the last ones were created here in Devon. Think about that. The first was Totiford near Hennock, eastern Dartmoor, and that was as far back as 1861. The most recent reservoir in Devon was Meldon up near Okehampton, completed 1970, and a stunning place if you've never been there. But with the Hennock trio of reservoirs, the engineering required back in the 1860s for getting the pipes down through the granite was so complex that they had to employ a company from London to do all the contract work. It was a company called William Press & Sons from Westminster. Must have been quite an undertaking. So Hazeldown, as I said, was early 20th century, and that at the time was simply used for local supplies, but as with all other small reservoirs, it has to be topped up from the larger ones. And still connecting with Tynmouth and water storage, you must know about Venford Reservoir up above Holne on Dartmoor. It's not too far from the village of Holne. And that was completed in 1907. But I wonder how many of you know about Albert Best, who was involved as a contractor during its construction. Now, Albert Best was a Tynmouth businessman, a really interesting man who seemed to walk miles a day and fitted in with all his work, which included making cast iron lined coffins, I believe. And his business was set in Somerset Place, just where they sell the takeaway food from on the corner where Somerset Place joins with Northumberland Place. Anyway, moving forward into the 1930s, our illustrious Urban District Council were pondering the problem of other seasonal happenings. You see, the railway line of 1846 had been really important in promoting Tynmouth as a holiday place, and other resorts too, of course. Well, now other resorts had run into drought situations because suddenly a town or a resort has got, say, three, four, five times as many people within it. And so Tynmouth Urban District Council said, oh, we can't afford to have that. It would be a catastrophe, you know, if people came here and there was a no water for them to use, they'd never come back. So a scheme was arrived at to supply the needs of both Shoulden and Tynmouth. Now, surprisingly, at the time, the water was being carried through a 9-inch diameter steel trunk main from a place very near to Fermoy's Garden Centre on the road between Newton Abbot and Totnes. The idea was to install a new 12-inch diameter pipe with a spun iron lining which would replace the old one and speed things up. It was going to be costly, and the health ministry was very generous and provided £27,000 towards the cost of this improvement. That's about 2 million quid in today's money. Work began in 1936, and when complete, a turn-on party was arranged for all the dignitaries and the top brass. At the time, though, Tynmouth Urban District Council chairman was too ill to attend, so his vice chairman, Albert Hocking, a boatman and a local character from the back beach, went in his place. With the prospect of a high-class luncheon to follow, the party made their way to the gathering place around the Volve at what they called the Meter House. So it all began, and just as the supply reached the new connection and rushed into the new pipe, suddenly a great jet of water from the adjacent inlet pipe shot into the air. Almost in the same moment, the ebullient councillor Hocking shouted, "Here we go, Tynmouth!" at the top of his voice. God, I wish I'd been there. Probably quite a few damp jackets around as well. Albert probably dined out on that for a very long time. His son, by the way, Tom Hocking, who was the manager of the South Western Electricity Board shop in Somerset Place, was a great Rotarian and was instrumental in getting Alice Cross her brand new centre built in 1978. So all this foregoing was sparked off by coming across this amazing photo in my archive of the construction of Hazeldown Reservoir early in the 20th century. It was just an enormous hole in the ground. And, you know, here we are at the moment thinking about dirty water, having seen that Channel 4 programme called Dirty Business, how pollution is being caused all over our country and our coast by the dreadful sewage situation. And so now we're hoping to get the public stirred up, those people that like to swim in the rivers and the seas who are putting themselves at risk over and over. And hopefully it will all come good if everybody gets onto their MP and says this is not on. If you haven't watched that programme on Channel 4, Dirty Business, I suggest you do. Because it all comes down to one fundamental thing that we cannot live without, and that is water. Well, I'll stop dripping on now. Bye-bye.
It's over to Fran with the answers to the quiz questions.
Here I am again with those answers that I promised you earlier. Are you ready? Then let's go with question one. What type of creature is a bittern? The answer was C, a bird. Question two. According to a poem by Sir Walter Scott entitled Marmion, Oh What a Tangled Web We Weave When First We Practice What? The answer is C, to deceive. Question three. What colour do Oxford students wear at a sporting event when representing their university? The answer is C, dark blue. Question four. What does a cricket umpire indicate by raising his index finger in the air? The answer is again C, out. Question five. Which US state, nicknamed the Sunshine State, is known for the amusement parks and the production of oranges? The answer is C, Florida. Do you know, I've just realised how many answers are turning out to be C this month. I didn't mean to do this, but if you have been guessing, the last option each time, then you will have done quite well so far. Anyway, on with the next batch of answers. Question 6. Rod Laver is a former world number one player in which sport? Yes, the answer was C, tennis. Question 7. House, harvest and wood are all varieties of which British mammal? The answer to this one was actually B, mouse. Question 8. Which famous author lived at Greenaway House on the River Dart? The answer was B, Agatha Christie. Question 9. Phyllis Logan played Lady Jane Felsham in which BBC comedy drama series? The answer was B, Lovejoy. And finally, question 10. In which county is the historic town of Sandwich? The answer was, you guessed it, C, Kent. Well, that's it for this month's brain teaser. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll go back to my desk and try to find another batch of questions ready for next month. Bye for now.
David is here with My Great Passion in Life, Part 2.
Hello again. It's David from the Red Team, and you may remember that last month I spoke about my lifelong passion for the entire canon of Gilbert and Sullivan. Well, I think there's more to be said this month, if you don't mind. I'm sometimes asked who I think is the more significant member of the partnership. Well, I have to say that, for me, it's a tie. They are intrinsically linked, and each contributes to the whole creation. What a pure delight for me. During the London season, from the late 60s to the early 80s, I used to go to Sadler's Wells Theatre about 3 times a week to see the Dorley Carp productions of the operas during their 8 to 10 week season. The staff there thought it would be cheaper for me to buy my seat in the front row rather than pay for it each time. Sometimes, at the end of the performance, the conductor would turn around to me and ask me what I'd thought of it. It was his opinion that Princess Ida was the most difficult to stage. I forget his reason now, but it is the only one that's in 3 acts rather than the standard 2. The music in the operas ranges from the almost grand opera style to easy listening, with almost foot-tapping musicality. Indeed, Arthur Sullivan was an extremely versatile and talented composer, as he also wrote The Lost Chord, The Tune for Onward Christian Soldiers, choral works, 2 ballets, and a grand opera Ivanhoe, based on Walter Scott's novel. The so-called patter songs are a special feature of the Savoy operas. They add to the story and are often sung at breathtaking speed. A well-known example of this is, and you'll know it, I think, I am the very model of a modern major general. I've information vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the things of England. I call the facts historical from Marathon to Waterloo in all categorical, although nowhere near the fastest. That accolade probably belongs to a song from Ratigore. My eyes are fully open to my awful situation. That is fast. To counteract such extravagances, there are some really beautiful arias. A great favourite of mine is sung by Dr. Daly, the Vicar of Plutherly in The Sorcerer. And another is Poor Wandering One, sung by a soprano in Pirates, and you probably know that one. Do I have a favourite amongst them all? Well, yes I do, but more of that in a moment. My least favourite is probably Yeoman of the Guard, set in the Tower of London, because, for whatever reason, it just doesn't do it for me, even though it is widely considered the Hamlet of Gilbert and Sullivan. Well, I, I have to confess that many consider that a complete sacrilege. It does, however, contain the haunting and tragic song I Have a Song to Sing O, sung by travelling jester Jack Point, who dies of a broken heart at the end. I am less familiar with either the last two operas, Utopia Limited and The Grand Duke, which, although they include some delightful songs, also have a great deal of tortuous and rather repetitive dialogue. Incidentally, Patience was the first work to be performed at the Savoy Theatre, and Iolanthe, with its famous Nightmare song, the first to be performed there using that life-changing modern invention. What was that? Well, electricity, of course. And now for my top three in reverse order. Number three, The Gondoliers, for its musical vibrancy and unforgettable characters. Number two, HMS Pinafore, which first took me to Gilbert and Sullivan in a big way. And in first position, Iolanthe, with its satire on the British parliamentary system and all-round songs and arias. I also like the most popular of them all, The Mikado, with its plethora of well-known songs and Japanese-themed characterisation. But it's actually not anything to do with Japan at all. It's a satire on Britain. It was a very sad ending to the Dolly Cart Opera Company, or their existence, however. The company ran into serious financial problems and was refused pecuniary assistance from the Arts Council. And so, on Saturday, the 27th of February 1982, gave its last performance at the Adelphi Theatre in the Strand in London. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I happen to know that because I was there. However, trying to be positive amidst all the gloom, the company's swan song was a triumphant chorus from the Gondoliers. We leave you with feelings of pleasure, which I hope we're going to hear now.
Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest, Luke Whitlock, Fran Frank, David Picton, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Norma Orty, Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob, Roland Burrows, Jenny Horton, Sue Smallwood, Viv Wilson, and David Quay. Thanks also to David Picton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor.